the job of film scoring is very, it's pretty hard. Firstly, just emotionally, when it comes to writing emotions, you have to be able to conjure any emotion and any degree of emotion, which is hard. So you might write a really nice piece of music, but let's say someone says, you know, we changed our minds. We don't think that in these 2 seconds we really don't want sadness. We want melancholy. And then at the snap of a finger, you have to change that.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. Colin Aguiar is an award-winning Indian-Canadian composer based in Los Angeles who specializes in film scoring. In this conversation, we talked about his youth, growing up across parts of India, the Middle East, Europe, and Canada, and studying the music of various cultures, learning different instruments with a start on drums as a toddler, as well as his love for the music of Arvo Pärt and other great composers. Colin spoke about some of his mentors, including Michael Dana. This episode with Colin is the first release of several film composers I've interviewed recently, and I find it fascinating how diverse their musical backgrounds are and what a challenging and little understood part of the music world this is. During the episode, you'll hear some clips from Colin's compositions used with permission. Like all my episodes, this is available on your favorite podcast player as well as a video, and the transcript is linked as well to my website, leahroseman.com. Colin Aguiar, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Leah. I'm really honored to be on this podcast. I've listened to some of your interviews and I love them. Big fan.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I was just saying to you before we started recording that I will be interviewing a few film and television composers, but you're absolutely the first, and it's really great that we can talk
about.
Oh,
thank you.
A very unique corner of the music world, I would say.
I guess so. Yeah, there's many corners, and I guess this is one of them. It's not unique to me. It's I wake up to it every day. So,
well, I don't always like to start with people's childhoods, but I think in your case, you had such an interesting upbringing musically. If we could just start to talk about your background and your family and the encouragement and inspiration you got from your dad.
Yeah. So, my dad was a pop singer, and being in a band for so many years, you pick up instruments and you start to play them, guitars, drums, whatever it happens to be. And he was familiar with the drums, and so when I came around, I guess it was their idea to get this toy drum set and see if, you know, I mean, it just as a toy. And for some reason, they noticed, that I was taking to it or something. I don't have a perfect recollection of what happened when I was like two, but apparently I was taking to it really well, and they started noticing, and it got to the point where they said, should we get him a real drum set? And so they got me a real drum set when I was four, and we still have it today. I love that drum set a lot. It's I just started, I guess I had natural rhythm back then. Not anymore. Is it strange? I can't dance, but I have natural rhythm. I assure you.
That's funny you say you can't dance, because
I don't dance. I refuse to dance.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Most musicians I know don't dance at parties. It's not a thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if we're like extra self-conscious about rhythm or something, but that's kind of interesting, actually.
And I've been around ballet dancers. I know what it's supposed to look like. I'm not graceful, so I just stay out of that lane. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you were four when you had a full-size drum set, how did that even work?
You mean as in reaching for things?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to explain, but yeah, we had a stool. We still have the same stool, mm-hmm. and the what's called drum throne, I guess. It was lowered to the lowest level, and the snare was lowered to the lowest level, and the hi-hat was lowered to the lowest level, and everything was lowered to the lowest level. I'd also do these sets, my parents would get invited to a lot of weddings, and so they'd invite me on stage to do a set with a band, five or six or seven, and they'd lower everything so that I could do a set, and But the thing is, the size of due to the size of a drum set, I'd always the tom toms would be like this, and no one would really see me. I'd stare at people dancing through the tom toms, but no one would really see me playing. So they'd just see sticks flying once in a while.
So your uncle was in the band along with your dad?
Yeah, my uncle was in the band that my dad had. And that's how I guess you met my mom. So it was all in the band, I guess.
And your parents, maybe we can talk about their immigration story because it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, so my parents are from India originally. And so I guess there are a section of Indian people. It's pretty popular that people go outside of India and primarily, you know, they'll earn a living and send money back to their families. And that's how I think it started for both parents individually. But they started to really enjoy the life outside of India, and I guess they just stayed. They went from India to Kuwait. They met in Kuwait, and then we went to we still go back and forth to India like every year. We immigrated to Canada, but before that we do summers and stuff in either England or Amsterdam, and then to Canada, and then eventually I went to the States, to LA. So I also studied in India for a period of time. I did some college there, and I did some high school there as well. And I had a lot of school changes. I had like 9 high school changes internationally.
Wow.
So, as a kid, you question it a lot because you know, everyone else gets to play with other kids in the summer. And it's like, why me? You know, like, why do I have to leave? But that question is answered now, you know, because, in my work, there does tend to arise the question of pulling off ethnic music authentically, and I find that all that time I was just accumulating these this kind of like a degree in ethnomusicology, because you get to ethnic music is full of nuances, and I was lucky enough to kind of experience these nuances firsthand.
So the part of India that your parents are from, Goa, is more like Western music influenced.
India is by far one of the most diverse populations. Even though we were in a part of the population, a minority part of the population that was populated by Catholics, you partake in Hindu celebrations, you partake in Hindi language movies, you partake in Muslim celebrations as well. And so Bollywood was a part of that. It was just a part of, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't far removed by any chance. It was really, a part of the vernacular. You know, Bollywood movies just kind of enter your everyday on a minute-to-minute basis. So, yeah, Bollywood movies. And at home, it was a lot of classical training. But both of those things together. Mm-hmm. And when we lived in the Middle East, it was a lot of Arabic tradition as well. So all of that was spinning at the same time.
I thought this would be an interesting point for the listeners to hear some of your music. And I thought we could play the clip from the movie Fly about an immigration story in which you incorporate Indian sounds with Irish sounds. So if you could talk to that clip that people are going to hear, that would be really good.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Fly was a really, really... important movie for me. It was one of the first ones I did. It was a short film. It was so good. It went to the Toronto International Film Festival, and was recognized by a lot of critics to also have garnered critical attention. The reason why that movie was important is because it explored immigration or the displacement of immigrants in a foreign country in a really poetic way. There was hardly any dialogue in that movie, and so a lot of responsibility fell on the music. To, you know, the music kind of explained and verified, you know, facial expressions or the mood of the scene, and it really was a you know, pretty big driver in defining the narration of that movie for the audience. And so musically, it became the question of how are we going to express that, since it has such a, you know, large voice. And we went through a number of ideas with the director, who I'm still friends with. We're still very close friends, because that experience was so bonding, I would say. But in that journey, what we discovered worked best would be an Indian ensemble. I should preface by saying the story is about a boy in an Indian family. And the boy, he doesn't explicitly say this, but the boy is pretty much intrinsically Canadian. You know, his way of thinking, the way his brain is wired is Canadian. And in a way, symbolically, is different from his parents. And so to have that symbolic transition to the music, what it turned out to be was an Indian ensemble with a couple Celtic instruments in the center of it. So the Celtic instruments would hold melody and would be the harmonic support would be handled by the Indian ensemble. And it was a very, almost like a mirror effect in the ensemble, as in both ensembles, the acting ensemble and the musical ensemble. And it kind of worked. You know, it also, I should say that, you know, both cultures, you know, the Irish culture, which is one of the originating cultures in Canada, and Indian music, have you know, this pentatonic scale that, or not entirely pentatonic, but there are some harmonies that that overlap, and in that way, you know, there is this overlap between the son and the parents, and so it just was a really, really great way to mirror what was happening on screen.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for sharing that.
Thanks, Leah.
That's great. Another thing that might be good to talk about now is Torn from Her Arms.
Okay.
Because that, you know, in terms of the migration story. So that is very different music.
What this movie is about is family separation. A few years ago, when migrant families would arrive at the U.S. border, children were separated from their parents. And then through a breakdown of the system, were never reunited. And this is this traces the story of one mother-daughter family that were reunited, but through a lot of pain and a lot of fighting the system. And so this movie, it's got an orchestral score in the first place, but the language of the orchestral score is mainly very, it was inspired by one of my favorite composers, Arvo Pärt, this Estonian composer, who bases a lot of his work on scripture and on his adoration of his Christian faith. He's very dedicated to his Christian faith. And the symbolism here is that there are things in the Christian Catholic faith that apply to the treatment of people, you know, do unto others like you would have being done unto you. And so there was this really great overlap in philosophy that needed to be imparted on the story, and rightly so, because the audience is also very Judeo-Christian.
So I didn't have a chance to see this movie. So is the whole score similar to this string writing, or is this just part of it?
Yeah, the whole score is similar to it. So it's done in the rules set forth by Arvo Pärt for his harmonic structure.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. And I'm curious about the use of synthesizers, and I know that sometimes you'll have an opportunity to score for live musicians, and sometimes you'll be using synthesized sounds depending on the project. Synthesized sounds have come a long way, right, in terms of the quality of the samples. So what is your experience of that in your time in the industry? Has it already changed? Or
I guess when you enter this topic, there are two There's two groups of synthesized sound, you could say. One is synthesized sound that is concerned just with synthesizers and electronic music and things that do not sound orchestral. Mm-hmm. And then there's the group of synthesis where the aim is to produce something orchestral. The thing with this job is that technology is something you just can't escape. You know, it's a very important factor. And if uh, there wasn't there was a time when I wasn't that good at synthesis, so electronic synthesis. And you just kind of learn it, you know. If you don't have something, you just kind of try to acquire that knowledge. So yeah, you can't really pass go without you know absorbing it.
And before we leave it, in the music from The Fly, the first excerpt we played. So was that all written out? Like, were you working with musicians who are all music readers, or do sometimes people learn by ear for scores? You know what I mean?
That's a good question. When I recorded all the Celtic stuff, it was mostly Ilian pipes. Actually, you know what? It was done quite a while ago, so I'm trying to recollect everything that I did for that score. So basically, it's Ilian pipes and all this Indian stuff around it. And the Ilian pipes, I remember, I showed the session player the music, but it was way better to just do it by ear. Mm-hmm. He just found himself to be a lot more untethered, mm-hmm. and his performances were just better without reading anything. So, you know, some musicians really love something extremely specific. Those are probably musicians that are trained to read and have a certain expectation in their part that directs every nuance of what they do. And other people, you know, it's a discussion. So yeah, it depends.
Yeah, I was just curious about that. And this other clip, this beautiful variation you did on the El Salvadorian national anthem, also relates. It's not from the same movie of the Torn from Her.
It's a separate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I went and listened to the original anthem, of course, and heard how martial it was, and it was very interesting to hear that contrast. Yeah. So what inspired you to write this?
It was also inspired by these immigrants that were coming, or migrants that were coming to the border. And you know, the thing about I would think, you know, maybe it fluctuates from country to country, but most people, I think, would have a pride in where they come from. And even if you don't have such a resounding pride in where you come from, at least, you know, there are things about where you grow up and where you live that you tend to love and get used to, and you know, relationships you build. And when someone leaves their country to go somewhere else, they're also leaving behind all those things that they love and that they're used to and their routine. And you know, human beings don't always love change. You know, they don't wake up every day looking for change. So it was inspired by the fact that a lot of these people have to mourn a lot of what they grew up with. And that's why that piece of music, unlike the original, is more of a lament. It's more of a mournful take on the original anthem. You know, it's more of, it says, you know, I'm missing you, as opposed to, you know, something else that's emoted in the anthem.
Did you write the lyrics for that?
No, I borrowed that from the actual anthem as well. And okay. it was performed by an El Salvadorian singer as well.
Yeah, beautiful singing.
Yeah, thank you. She's amazing.
Saludemos la patria orgullosos de hijos suyos por vernos llamar.
So maybe we could go back now. So we started talking about a little bit about your upbringing. I remember you had told me previously you had a very influential percussion teacher, drum teacher, who exposed you to lots of cultures through music and you worked with for a long time.
Yeah, so this guy was a friend of my dad's who was another drummer on the scene, although a very, very good drummer. And he didn't purposely expose me to all these different cultures. But, you know, the thing is, you know, while learning a number of other instruments, drum set just happens to be an instrument where what you learn, if you go the jazz route, is you learn rhythms, and all these rhythms come from different parts of the world. So when my teacher was telling me about these things, you know, he'd tell me the origins of something like the Beguine or the rumba or the cha-cha-cha or the tango and where these things come from, or Afro-Cuban rhythms, or rhythms from Havana and stuff. So, you know, and if you really look at it, you know, each one of these beats or rhythms that I mentioned have a huge history. You know, there's a huge cultural process that might have taken decades, if not centuries, to evolve to. They all have other rhythms that they come from. They have the influence of other cultures sometimes. So it's a combination of things. There's always, or in most cases, there's always a dance that comes with it, you know? And just as a lot of these rhythms have grooves, which are not always on the beat, which are, you know, just sometimes a microsecond behind the beat or in front of the beat, you know, those things, even though I'm putting them technically, all translate into gestures and mannerisms from the cultures that they come from. And those mannerisms are in the attitude that people exercise their daily life in those countries or in those parts of the world. And so you can't help but think that, you know, if I want to get this Argentinian rhythm correctly, maybe, you know, I should know a little bit about the people in Argentina and where, you know, why this beat is the way it is. And so when you explore these things in maybe Northern Africa or Central Africa or South America or wherever whatever you're trying to study and break down, you'll eventually understand, you know, or begin to understand some of these cultures and scratch the surface. So learning drums just so happens to kind of be like a real nice little world tour of the world in a way that, you know, studying, doing violin etudes or playing the guitar or, you know, learning Bach on the piano won't really exercise that muscle. You know, it's the one instrument that will take you on that tour.
Mm-hmm. As we are recording this now, you haven't heard my episode with jazz drummer Micah Sudri, but it will be released soon. So it's all jazz drum set episode, and we talk about a lot of the stuff, and he plays a lot.
Did he say anything similar?
People will listen to that. Anyway, for anyone interested in this topic, I'll just point them to that episode.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I'm an independent podcaster who does all the many jobs required to produce the series, and there are a lot of costs I bear as well. Please consider either buying me a virtual coffee as a tip or becoming a monthly supporter starting at $3 Canadian, which is close to $2 US or 2 euros, and getting access to unique perks. The link is in the description. Now back to the episode.
Yeah, so this, I know you were really invested as a percussion, as a drummer, but you also played other instruments. But how much were you putting into drumming when you were a kid? Like how many hours or how many years?
Yeah, this is, I would put in like, it was like instituted at home, like 5 hours a day.
What?
Like two and a half hours, it would be, you know, normal, if I couldn't do 5 hours a day. But basically goes 5 hours a day. I don't really have much of a life outside of music, really.
But your parents expect you to play drums that much, or you just got into that routine?
Oh, no, they both. I mean, if I didn't, you know, put in 5 hours a day, you know, they'd be like, why haven't you put in 5 hours a day? Sometimes it would be split up. Sometimes it wouldn't always be 5 hours at a stretch. You know, it'd be like 2 hours, 2 hours, 2 hours or something like that. But yeah, 5 hours a day.
Why do you think they were putting pressure for that much time? Were they worried about your success as a musician, that you need to be at the top of your game, or?
No, in the end, they didn't really want me to be a musician, but I don't know. I have no idea. That's a good question. I don't know what end game that would have served them, but I don't know. I guess maybe they wanted me to be good at something. And yeah, it's the only thing I'm good at, so that explains it. But it's not like I hated it. I enjoyed it as well. So
when I know you played some other instruments, when did you find time to do that?
That was introduced along the same time, but as I grew up, you know, there were just more instruments added, mostly piano and guitar, and then violin on my own. It was part of practice, you know. But by the time piano and guitar was introduced, you know, I had already had this proficiency at drums. So I could split my 5 hours into, you know, 2 hours in drums and 3 hours on everything else. Depending on, you know, what I needed to better at, I would just kind of spend more time there.
And you started composing when you were fairly young as well.
Yeah. I was like 10. I was doing arrangements and stuff, yeah.
So arrangements of songs you were hearing, or what kind of?
Yeah, I would, you know, the thing is that, you know, I found my piano lessons to be so boring. And so I'd be like, you know, I'd go to my teacher and I'd say, hey, you know, could we do this pop song or something? And she'd say, well, if you can find the sheet music for it. And I couldn't find the sheet music for it. So I'd write the sheet music for it. And that's kind of how a lot of arrangements started. But then, you know, I would write the sheet music for a pop song in like a Latin rhythm, because of drums, and so that's how these arrangements would get started, mm-hmm. and then offshoot into, you know, composition and stuff.
And when you were in high school, you'd started to write full-length musical theaters pieces for fun.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't for fun. It was more like I got really serious about it, and I just enjoyed it. I really love musical theater. It was something I really did with a huge passion.
What I meant when I said for fun, Colin, I didn't mean to put it down. I meant you weren't being asked to write something for a specific performance. It was.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah, no, I do it in the summers. No one asked me to do it. I did it because this is something I wanted to do. Possibly I was thinking about it after high school. So it became something that that became a priority for me.
Mm-hmm. For those people listening to the podcast, it'd be nice to describe what I'm seeing here, and they can see the video later. You have three enormous screens behind you with your keyboard. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could talk about your gear and the necessary setup to do this kind of work.
Sure. Every composer is different. Every composer has a unique studio. For the most part, it's kind of the same. The reason I have screens is because I personally believe that the eye is faster than the hand, the arms, and so if I can see things, if a number of windows are open and my eyes can dart from one screen to the next, It's much faster than my hands can do that, especially when you're using a mouse. And a mouse is, if you really look at it in the real world, if you're cooking with just one finger, you know, it's gonna take a long time. But you know, you have five fingers and two hands and two eyes, and so you that's why, you know, cooking is so much faster than moving a mouse. So the philosophy of the screens is to be able to maximize what I can see so I can move fast.
I was wondering what you would have up on the separate screens then when you're working.
Yeah. Oh, what's on the separate screens? I use a program called Logic Pro. It's made by the Apple company. And they have something called the arrange page, or basically the work page where most of the work is done. I have that on my main screen. On the screen above, I usually have the film playing. And on the two side screens, I usually have all my tools, you know, tools that enable me to see the length of notes or what it would look like on a printed piece, printed manuscript, or allow me to affect the mix of the music, as in, you know, if let's say, you know, the brass is now playing the melody and needs to sound higher than the string section, and then if they recede into the harmony, they need to recede into the mix. So those are things that I'll manipulate on another screen. But these are all things that have to happen at the same time. As you can tell, you know, each of the one, all these things that I mentioned happen, continually change on a second-to-second basis. And they continually need to be manipulated on a second-to-second basis. And so I need to kind of manage these fluctuations from second to second. And that's why I need to have them all in eyeshot.
Mm-hmm. So this short film, your score was widely acclaimed for. Do you pronounce it Construct or Construct?
Whichever one. No one's okay. No one's really out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did watch it. Interesting use of the technology, but certainly the music made the film, in my opinion. So we can play the clip you've selected. This dubstep is used with this orchestral score.
I'd always been a fan of dubstep music. I go to dubstep concerts. I really admire the genre. It's a different discipline of synthesis that is very unique and is, you know, very admirable, all the things that they do in this genre. When this movie came along, it wasn't very hard to see that dubstep actually does sound like robots talking. And so it was, you know, again, this really beautiful overlap.
Thanks for that clip.
And, oh, thank you.
Yeah. Maybe we could talk about one of your mentors, Michael Danna, and how he helped you in the profession.
Yeah, Michael, I've known Michael for a long time. Yeah, I would say Michael, you know, in the beginning, he just, you know, was really nice, and he called me over to his place once when I, you know, after I talked to him on the first time, and he said, you know, maybe you can play me some of your music. And I played him my music, and I didn't really know, you know, how much he would appreciate this, but in hindsight, I played him some Arab music that I'd written. I played him some Indian music. And I didn't know how much of an ethno music buff he was. But I think that immediately set some giant overlap between our two skill sets. And of course the orchestral stuff. So it was definitely just two people that had common interests, you know, that had a lot of fun listening to the same music together.
So you had assisted him on Life of Pi, was one of the first projects?
No, the first project that came through the studio was the tail end of an Angmin movie called The Ice Storm, and mm-hmm. then was The Sweet Hereafter, and then came a movie that not too many people know about. It's called Regeneration, they might have changed the title. It's a really beautiful World War I movie. So it was a few projects between then and Life of Pi. And so that was when we both lived in Toronto. And then he moved to LA, and then I moved to LA, and then we did Life of Pi. Yeah.
Okay. And so in terms of your apprenticeship in the business and learning about all the different jobs in as a role of composer, maybe you could talk to some of that, like your opportunity to write filler and how you're able to learn from a master like Michael and so on.
Yeah, I've worked for actually six different composers. Mm-hmm. And I would say the thing about film music is that most people think of music as being very simple, and they think of film music as being even simpler than, you know, popular music. But in fact, the job of film scoring is pretty hard, mainly because what you're doing is, firstly, just emotionally, when it comes to writing emotions, you have to be able to conjure any emotion and any degree of emotion, which is hard. So if you have, you know, jealousy, you know, how do you, you know, happy and sad is pretty black and white, but how do you emote jealousy or envy, or how do you, you know, what are the different ranges of happiness, you know, melancholy, and you might write a really nice piece of music, but let's say someone says, you know, we changed our minds. We don't think that in these 2 seconds, we really don't want sadness. We want melancholy. And then at the snap of a finger, you have to change that. Like, the changing things on a dime is what makes film composition, which has to be done on a schedule, different from music that has the luxury of no deadline or very distant deadlines. But in addition to that, is the fact that it's a very technological field, and the technology over the years from when I trained with these six composers has changed. You know, used to have racks and racks of synthesizers and tape machines, and now you have a single computer, or you have a Pro Tools machine. And so these things, and also there's the thing of your endurance or your work ethic, which is very different from any other field, whether in music or not. The mentality of always being in service of your team, working with a team, all of these things are things that doesn't really occur to you when you think of film music, but these are things that I acquired from working with all these people that I still carry today, you know. And I think it can't be undersold, because it kind of I use these tools every second of every day.
And when you say these tools, you mean what you're just talking about, the technology, or you mean personal tools to be able to transmit emotion? It's very specific emotions in music.
Yeah, both. You know, my impression was that, you know, for a piece of classical music, if you're writing a symphony or something, you do have a deadline, but you might have, like, I don't know, like months or a year to do, you know, 15, 20 minutes of music. But over here, in film music, you might have to do like 85 minutes of music in 3 weeks. What does your body go through? You know, what, you know, if you're not really, if you have to work, you know, a ton of hours, you know, what is your frame of thought? You know, how do you always remain receptive to changes on a team, or, you know, your outlook to working hard is not the same as when you have the luxury of time, you know? So I would say that these are some invaluable things that are passed on, I think, in these apprenticeships. It's not a typical job, so you need someone to tell you what typical is, and it's far from a common day understanding of typical.
So was it a shock for you when you started working in the business, just how hard you had to work, how many hours you had to put in?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I worked for an amazing composer, Lou Natale, who was the first composer I ever worked for. Most people won't know Lou, but Lou was a Canadian composer who was originally American. And he worked his ass off. You know, we were doing commercials and we'd work till like sometimes 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And I was young at the time, and I remember working at 4 o'clock in the morning, and we still had ways to go before the presentation to the ad agency. And Lou would say, you know, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. And he'd say, oh, Colin, you know, that really does suck. Hey, you know what you should do? You should just go out and like walk around the block and come back. And I was amazed he said that, because typically at any job, you don't work at 4 o'clock in the morning. But that is exactly what you have to do when you're on a deadline. Just, you know, walk it off and come back and make your deadline.
Yeah. Do you think the discipline you learned as a young person practicing that many hours, it must have helped you in terms of that aspect?
You're very right. There is that carry forwarding of that attitude. The one thing I think of a lot is the kind of sacrifice, and social sacrifice. All the time I was practicing as a musician, as a kid growing up, it would be with other kids playing in the background outside my home. And I never got to do that. And now, you know, there'll be fireworks going off for New Year's or whatever it is. Or there'll be, you know, some cars honking because a team won or something like that. I don't get to partake in that, or I don't get holidays or weekends off or anything like that. It is a pleasure to do this job, but sometimes the way the world turns, kind of, and all the celebrations that keep happening, are sometimes in your face, and it's good to have the practice of being immune to that kind of stuff.
Do you miss playing music, having the opportunity just to jam?
Once in a while, But I'd say my satisfaction, my spiritual satisfaction, comes from writing music. So so it's I find it kind of fulfilling. Yeah.
Yeah. It might be interesting to share. You wrote a palindrome, but it said palindrome 9 on the clip. So is this? Did you write many of them, or was it just the name of?
Yeah, growing up, I would write palindromes, just for the fun of it, just for the exercise. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this one palindrome I wrote for Construct, and this one has the added difficulty of not just being played backwards the same, but I reversed the audio. So once the whole thing is recorded, played forward and backwards on paper, then the whole audio is reversed. And so if you take the full piece on a whole and reverse it, it'll sound exactly the same.
So, Colin, when you say good values, you mean more complex or like more artistic?
Well, what I mean by that is that they have found better ways to build a building for it not to collapse, or you know, the stairs have given ways to escalators and elevators. There's better ways of doing things in medicine, and so every generation builds on something that the previous generation has. And it occurs to me that, you know, there's so much discovery. There's, you know, everything from microtonality to palindromes to variations on themes. There's so much in terms of composition that previous generations have challenged themselves with. And so it just kind of is logical that you would acknowledge that and try to continue in that tradition. You know, it's just, I don't know, for me, I can't speak for anyone else, but for me, it's almost like a responsibility, you know, but especially since I hold those composers in such high regard. I just love them so much that, my admiration kind of gives way to maybe advancing the pattern, maybe, if I can put it that way.
So someone like Bach wrote palindrome. So the fact that you did take piano lessons for years, you were able to play Bach and access that music in a different way than just listening.
Yeah, and listening is as much of a complex exercise as performing as well, especially when it comes to Bach. But yeah, you know, things like that, you know, the genius of that guy to come up with inventive mathematical, it's not just Bach, it's Hector Villa-Lobos, or it's Albert Pert, or it's John Tavener, you know, it's all of these composers, Michael Dana, like, You know, it's John Williams. You know, it's any one of these really admirable composers that there's so much to learn from. You know, Schoenberg, Paul Hindemith, you know, all very, very astute, knowledgeable composers that that developed some great techniques, you know.
How much composition did you study formally?
Formally, almost, well, I studied with an Estonian composer. His name was Dr. Roman Toy. He was a great composer, and one thing he's known for is choral work. And maybe that's where my admiration for Avril Peart comes in, because Avril Peart and Dr. Roman Toy were both Estonian composers, and I was introduced to this really rich tradition coming from Estonia and Eastern Europe. I would say Dr. Toy is the one person that helped me understand harmony in a different way. I will say with also working with these other composers, like, you know, Lou, for example, was brought up in a jazz tradition. He grew up studying jazz harmony. But I will say all of these different composers, they kind of are all swimming in there, you know, at some point. I give them all credit, because there's not a day that I skip invoking some memory of them at some point. So it might not have been extremely formal, but it was, you know, kind of, I regard it as an a la carte education. You know, there's something I realize I don't have, I'll just go grab it.
Do you want to speak to some of your other mentors?
Well, I worked for so many of these people. I worked for Lou Natale in Canada. I worked for John Welsman, another amazing, truly amazing composer. I worked a little bit for Glenn Morley, to a certain extent. Then in the States, I worked for Michael Dana, a friend, Robert Duncan, Christopher Young, the great Christopher Young, whose music is so full of detail and nuance and great orchestration. And beyond that, you know, every day, I would say every free day that I get that I'm not writing, I'm studying some composer. You know, if it's not, recently it's been Strauss, but it can be, you know, Bartok. It can be the harmonies of George Gershwin. It could be the melodic or choral writing of Irving Berlin or Cole Porter. It can be, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan. It just goes, Toru Takemitsu, composers whose names I don't know. John Williams, you know, for orchestration, it can be any number of things. But the thing is that, all of these things are being used at the same time. You know, it's all in a month's work, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You had mentioned to me before that in your mesh with your soundscape, you're always hearing a score. It's like there's an internal radio that's different than most people. I think a lot of us have earworms, or we might have something in our mind that we were just listening to or playing. But for you, it's more integral and more realized than that.
Yeah, I don't know what this is. I don't know what this is. This is, maybe I'm crazy. I don't know what this is. Like, I constantly have music going in my head, no matter how loud or softly, but it's always going. So I'll step onto a street or step in the car, and there's always a soundtrack. It's always a soundtrack playing. It's just automatic.
But when you're listening to music, that doesn't drown out the music you're listening to. That'll set that aside.
When I'm listening to music, it's, you know, the music's being, I'm listening to it as individual parts, you know. Mm-hmm. All the orchestration is stretched out, and I'm listening to, you know, compression or equalization or mix issues or compositional, you know, analysis, so stuff like that.
Are you able to easily remember chord progressions?
Yeah.
And how about, are you able to take dictation quite easily if you hear a score? Can you write it down?
Yeah.
So that stuff just comes very naturally to you?
I guess so. Yeah.
Or was that training? I guess that's what I'm getting at.
No, it's a part of this craziness. It's it's part of this affliction. I was always able to memorize something. It's kind of like a conversation. You know what I think? I think when it happens from when you're two, it becomes a language maybe. Mm-hmm. So when other people, maybe this is it. When you're thinking in a language, you're thinking about what to say. Maybe I have a language going on, and maybe I'm thinking in that language, and it happens to be music. So I don't really have an explanation for it, but maybe it's my emotional language that's constantly going.
Mm-hmm. And I know you have you've gotten interested in many different styles of music over the years. When I was researching, one thing that came up that I was interested in was Kathakali, because that's a style I wasn't familiar with. So then I was, you know, watching videos of this very interesting dance. And I was curious, because also at a certain point, you were very interested in opera and musical theater. And as a film and television composer, we're dealing with characters and often certain motives for characters. So how does that relate to those types of music?
Kathakali is a dance that happens, the dance tradition of South India. But the thing is that, you know, it's no different. It's no different from acquiring that knowledge in what's happening in Kabuki theater, or what's happening in theater in like Central Africa, or the evolution of dell'arte, you know, in Italy, or how, you know, theater evolves in the courts in England, you know. So I think just kind of like the knowledge of all these different offshoots in history just kind of play into everything else, you know. Like there might be a character that has a certain bent towards any one of these things, and when you identify this character trait, or when you identify a certain nod that a script has to a certain social movement or point in history, it becomes even richer to imbue those scenes with something from that era, you know, or something from that geography. So, yeah, just kind of, you know, constantly studying the stuff sometimes just, you know, comes to your rescue.
Yeah.
So I just keep studying, you know.
Yeah. Well, just in terms of the formulas that would be used in Kathakali to represent certain narrative things or emotions. And I know that opera composers have done the same thing. I guess that's what I was getting at. Just the technique of using music in that way for dramatic purposes.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same thing in ballet as well, you know. It's not that different, you know, the idioms are different, but there's the same principle. And, you know, the same thing in that, the same techniques in ballet or in Wagner are just replicated in some way in film music, you know. It's just the duplication of not duplication, but an intelligent way of paralleling emotion or reflecting the subtext. So yeah, it's kind of like the same principles, but, you know, maybe updated or done in a different way, but the same principles.
So, Colin, do directors and producers give composers a lot of direction in terms of how much scoring they want? If they want, you know, like a John Williams movie tends to have music almost the entire way through, and then some styles are more spare. I guess that's what I'm getting at.
So it, and this is where it's all really collaborative. Mm-hmm. We really talk about what kind of a movie this is going to be, whether it's going to be, you know, with wall-to-wall, what they call wall-to-wall music, or whether it's going to be sparse. This is definitely a conversation that goes two ways. With most directors, you know, I'll definitely listen to everything, and then, you know, my ideas are also listened to. Sometimes, you know, we agree to lean more to one side or the other. It really depends on project to project. But some, to answer your question, some movies do deserve treatment where it's more quiet, and others, you know, where it's not so quiet. Even John Williams has some movies where it's not carpeted with music that much, like, you know, Born on the 4th of July, maybe, you know, Catch Me If You Can isn't, you know, wall-to-wall music, such like Indiana Jones, for example, or Jurassic Park. So yeah, there are variants.
It's not often, but I like, sometimes it's the right feel when there's music that somebody turns on the radio and it's not like a song, you know, but it's written for the, you know what I mean? But it's incorporated so that there's a reason why there's music playing.
Yeah.
I like when that technique is used. Do you get decision fatigue in terms of having to make so many decisions every day creatively? Do you get tired of just having? No. Okay.
No. The reason being is because, you know, sometimes on another level, the job is all decision making. It's the art of decision making.
Mm-hmm.
It's the art of standing between the horns of a dilemma and knowing all the different possibilities, you know, having the most widest, richest spectrum of possibilities, and then analyzing the pros and cons of each one, going with the best one and doing it in a record amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So, the thing is that each decision, each quandary is very different from the last one. So it's challenging, and that challenge kind of keeps me engaged. So I like decision. Yeah.
So the time flow, is music one of the last things that's added before the final edits?
It depends on the people making the movie.
Mm-hmm.
People are starting to involve me a lot earlier now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very welcome. But very often, you know, you're sprinting to the project because you're one of the last people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So are you at liberty to say what your project is right now or not?
I'm a little superstitious, but
okay, that's fine.
But yeah, no, I hope it'll be a nice little project, a nice little documentary. We're figuring out some of the logistical things right now, but yeah, I think it'll be a very spiritually satisfying journey by the end of it. Yeah.
Okay. So are a lot of the projects you're doing sort of fairly long? Like, are you on something for 6 months or?
This one I will be,
mm-hmm.
But it runs the gamut. Some projects need something done in a matter of weeks. Other projects will sometimes need, you know, 3 or 4 months, which is mm-hmm. really welcome. You get to think things out, you know. So both are just fine.
So I'm curious, you haven't dipped your toe in the podcast music world, which is a whole thing now.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to. I listen to some podcasts almost daily, and it would be great to contribute to them. But, you know, the podcast stream or track is completely different, apparently. you write a whole bunch of things and hope that they get used or something like that. It's not really on a project by project basis. It's more of a library, yeah. What they call library basis. So it perplexes me, but yeah, you know, that'd be awesome if I did something for a podcast.
So this Sprite commercial, you had submitted another clip. Mm-hmm. So that was using a beatboxer. So how did you direct the, it wasn't done with synthesizer, right? It was a live human beatboxer.
Yeah. Really, I found someone in the world of commercial that's even faster than film and TV. Mm-hmm. You get literally a day maybe to do something like that. And so I found a beatboxer. He lived with his mom on the other side of town. I picked him up and I got in my place, and it was mostly me telling him the rhythm that I had in mind. And I kind of verbalized it for him, and he duplicated it, and he had a bunch of other ideas, and yeah, it kind of came together that way. But yeah, that was an interesting scenario. It was a scenario where I was completely broke and I didn't have any money to do this. And the owner of this jingle house called me and said, "Hey, do you want to take a stab at this?" There were at least 14 other options, and mine got picked. So yeah, it couldn't have come a moment later, because I really needed the money back then.
One thing we didn't talk about that could be interesting is some of the traditions in the film industry to use guide tracks, where they use a famous symphony or for another. Is that still done quite a bit?
Well, it's done for a number of reasons. The first reason it's done is because when they're editing a movie, they need to understand the flow of the scene. You know, mm-hmm. they need rhythm underneath each cut. Without rhythm, it can seem discombobulated. You know, it can seem very uncoordinated. So, and that's not something that audiences are very used to. So when you put a track of music underneath an edit, you suddenly know where to put each cut. But what'll happen is that everyone's working on a team, and there's many members of the team that have to look at those cuts, and many people can kind of start to fall in love or create an expectation of what the end result will be, end result meaning with music. Mm-hmm. That may include very close to that temp track. And so that can create, you know, a pressure on the composer, but not necessarily. You know, there are now this idea of this expectation and what they call temp love is now pretty popular. And so I think filmmakers now are more vigilant of that. When I get a film now, I usually don't get a temp track with it. So filmmakers now are kind of, you know, wise to this pitfall.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, especially when, you know, the recording that you use on a temp track, that recording, you just don't know the circumstances. Maybe that composer had 4 months to write something, and you know, the new composer doesn't have that time, or maybe they had vastly more money and a big music team of orchestrators, and maybe the composer for your film doesn't really have that luxury. So those parameters have to be kind of acknowledge, you know, the difference, which you won't really know, you know. So yeah, filmmakers these days I think are more attuned to the fact that to treat their composer within the parameters they're operating in.
Mm-hmm. That's more respectful too, right?
More practical, yeah, as well. Okay. Yeah.
Do you think you've well, had you stayed in Canada, I mean, we still have a pretty robust film industry in Toronto. Do you think you would still have had a lot of opportunities, or was your move to LA really created a lot more opportunities for you?
Both are great, you know. LA just has a lot more happening, you know, as opposed to Canada. And you know, in Canada, there's a lot of what we do is based on government funding. In the States, it's a lot more open-ended. But there's opportunities in everywhere. There's just more opportunities in the States, and you know, it fluctuates as well. The opportunities in the States during a recession go down, and who knows? You know, with policies can change, and you know, we're getting a lot of streaming services now in Canada that are setting up headquarters there. You really just don't know, you know. It's we're in a state of flux right now.
Mm. What, during the first part of the pandemic with the lockdowns, did you have projects canceled? Was there a lot of uncertainty in your business?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I had projects canceled, and there weren't things weren't happening because in order to make a movie you had to gather in big groups in big numbers and in close proximity. So you just could not, you just couldn't make a movie. And there were a number of trials. I remember reading the papers in the trades. There'd be movies attempting to film and not, and someone would get COVID and they'd be shut down again. Which, and if you really look at it, COVID protocols represented another expense on the film production. So they had to spend money there. And each time you shut down and revamp, that's another expense as well. So yeah, I'm glad we're out of it right now, but that was a dark time for sure.
Did you had extra time in your hands. Did you do creative things, or was it just really hard?
Yeah, I did some creative things. I did this one choral piece called Hymn for Our Times. Mm-hmm. It was using footage of LA that I found, and yeah, it was just, yeah, just there's always something to do. Yeah, the to-do list is a bottomless pit of to-dos.
I listened to him to our times. It's really beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
And your father was ill at the time as well when you wrote that.
Yeah, my dad was ill. He was passing away at that time.
Were you able to spend time with him because you were able to be back
in
Toronto?
Or? Yeah, I went back to Canada and I spent time with him. Yeah, you know, these part of life, I guess.
Was he happy that you had pursued film composition as a job?
Yeah, you know, he was to a certain extent. I mean, you know, I've Indian parents, so the direction of thought is always towards something where there's a predictable paycheck every 2 weeks or a month, mm-hmm. or whatever. But either way, you know, like, you know, my dad put this trade in my hand, more or less. And yeah, I think it's my purpose. So it's my vocation.
Yeah. Oh, it's a beautiful vocation. Thanks so much for sharing.
So is yours.
Well, thanks so much for sharing your experience today, Colin. It was really interesting.
Thank you, Leah. You know, I'm completely aware that I'm just a small composer in Toronto and LA, and I don't claim to be an expert on anything, but I just know my own experience, and hopefully I relate those authentically, and that's the bounds of my knowledge, really.
Well, it's an ongoing process, but I mean, you have your voice and your, I think what you're doing is so magical, you know, to, to convert. I can't even express it in words. I mean, music does it so much better.
Well, thank you so much, Leah. Thank you for the, you know, the reverence you give composers and musicians and music. I think it comes from you being a professional musician as well. And this is something I think people that generally interview musicians or in the musical arena are missing, because there's this insight into music or the thinking of a composer that a lot of people only kind of look at recreationally and from time to time, but not in depth. So your insight, your approach to it, your understanding of it, definitely shows. You know these questions are always on point. I watch your other interviews as well, and it brings out certain things from the people you're talking to that I don't think other interviews bring out. So I'm very honored to be one of the people you interviewed. So thank you, Leah.
Oh, thanks, Colin. Okay. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Thanks for following the series on your favorite podcast player and sharing your favorite episodes with your friends, all of which help find new listeners. I have lots more episodes coming in this season 3 with a fascinating diversity of musicians and their stories and music. Have a great week.